the show must go on.
Welcome to See You at the Show. This is Eric Schacht, and I am here with Linda Evans. How are you doing, Linda?
Good. How about you?
I'm good. I'm really good. I'm always good after hearing Jim Broadbent sing Moulin Rouge stuff. Like I was just saying, I just have started listening to the new Moulin Rouge soundtrack, and I'm kind of getting into it. It was way up there with Hadestown as the show that I wanted to see, and I saw Hadestown in New York, and I haven't heard that much about Moulin Rouge. Have you?
No.
I think that Laura and Luis went when they were out in Chicago, up in New York, sometime over the summer. So maybe I need to talk to them about it.
Yeah, maybe Kara Day did too. I know she saw a bunch of things when she was out there.
Yeah. That's actually something we should think about doing. When somebody, like in our local theater community, makes the big trip out to New York, they can come back and do like a spot.
That would be awesome.
Because we're so far away.
Yeah.
And it's such a rare thing to get to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just give me an excuse to talk about Hadestown, which I haven't brought up.
You might be obsessed.
I haven't brought up Hadestown in many, many episodes. Although, next week, we are going to do our season recap. Now, it's mostly going to talk about everything that's happened in 2019 in CU Community Theater at Parkland, at The Station, at CUTC, and at Twin City Theater Company. Those are the biggies.
Mm-hmm.
We can dabble in high school if we need to, but they've gotten enough attention.
And if there's any show that was local but not with one of those theater groups and you really want us to talk about it or cover it, let us know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because we did cover a couple of Monticello shows and publicize some Decatur and Danville stuff. But we have a lot of ground to cover just doing those.
Right.
Doing the four main.
But if there's some like favorite show, like you didn't mention this, like. Let us know.
Yes. And it is also a time to use our, when we're promoting our season ending recap show, to let us know what, who you think needs a shout out. What show do you really stood out to you, or meant something to you? What performance, what costumes, just like, let's celebrate the year that happened. And that's how we'll spend the day after Christmas.
Right.
Sound
here.
Good?
Yep, right here, talking about theater.
Great. Okay, so, and we are talking about theater. And what we have happening right now is the final, last three shows of It's a Wonderful Life at The Station. So that'll be tonight, Friday night, and Saturday night at 7:30. I think tickets are doing really well.
Yeah, they've been doing really well, but I know a couple people still haven't seen it that are going tonight and next couple nights, so... This is your last chance to go see it. And it really puts you in the holiday mood.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Gosh, we're in within a week. So it's a great time to see it. And it's really just such a fantastic cast who they have so much fun with this material. And Ed Pierce just adapted it in the coolest and most creative kind of way. And you have the sound effects. It's just...
And they have so much energy throughout the entire show. They have like half an hour before the show that they come out and sing carols and things like that. I don't know how they keep up the energy.
I don't know either.
That's amazing.
I think, you know, that's another reason to go like closing night and see if they really maintain that energy for all 13 shows. But they're great. They're great actors. So I know that they did. We also have some auditions, which are kind of creeping around the corner. CUTC's first auditions of the year are coming up for Steel Magnolias. And that is on... Magnolias. I said it right.
Yeah.
Which is my favorite all-time movie. It really. I say that about a lot of movies.
No,
but
that's one that I have on repeat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like a good cry.
It's a
Who
good
doesn't?
Movie, and it's got all these strong female characters, and all the actresses are amazing. Like, there's no one that you go, she stole the show. It's an ensemble type of show, and I love it.
Yep, and our community has tons of strong, wonderful women actors, and so there are no men in Steel Magnolias, so I will be left out of that one on January 11th. Go to the CUTC Facebook page, and you can see about that. That show opens then 2 months from that. It's four shows, one weekend in mid-March, so you can get it in before spring break. And The Moors is going to be the next show that opens. Speaking, and are you producing that?
I am. And speaking of really strong female characters, this cast is amazing. There's one guy, Matt Hester, is the Mastiff. But the rest of the cast is female. And I just cannot tell you how wonderful the show is going to be. Joy Hofsimer is in it, and Kimmy Schofield, and Mindy Smith, and Lindsay Gates-Markle, and Emmeline Johnson. And if that's not enough to get you in the door, it's
directed by Matthew Green.
Right, directed by Matthew Green, and Yenvi Green is the stage manager, and I'm producing, and it's at the station, and it's going to be so funny, and it's dark, and it's great, and it's, like, everything's funny. Like, I saw part of the rehearsal. I saw the rehearsal last night, and I just sat there, and I'm like, this is awesome. I can tell that some people are going to at first probably go, am I supposed to be laughing at this? Because it's really funny, but it's also dark. It's just fun in a way that no other show recently has done. So
wow, that's going to get 2020 off to a great start.
Excited about that. Yeah, and Kimmy's... her portrayal of Huldy. Thank you. Sorry. Yeah. I was like, wait, that's not right. Huldy is just creepy and cute, and it's just amazing. And I love the description that they have on the station website.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
About two sisters and a dog live out their lives on the bleak English moors, dreaming of of love and power. The arrival of a hapless governess and a moorhen. Emmeline Johnson is the moorhen, and I get to see her tonight at rehearsal, and I cannot wait to see that. There's a moorhen set all three on a strange and dangerous path. The Moors is a dark comedy about love, desperation, and visibility. So it's laugh-out-loud satire of gothic romance with a feminist twist and a left-arm hug to the Bronte sisters.
Wow.
Yeah.
It sounds like a great show for Matthew to do also. But, you know, considering the work that Kimmy did this year in On the Exhale and then in Elephant Graveyard, I just can't wait to see what she's got next.
Yeah.
And because she brings like this ferocity and intensity.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you're looking at me with like your eyebrows way up.
She's
like,
just,
I don't even know.
I don't even know how to describe it. And I've only seen a little bit of it. So I'm sure... as the weeks go on, because it doesn't open until January 16th. Although that's right around the corner, you know.
Yeah,
it feels like that's a long way away. But
you kind
of
got me thinking. I'm going to take a walk tonight and go peeking over the fence into the rehearsal space that I have secret access to. So maybe I'll start like doing
that's not
tours.
Creepy at all. Yeah.
Yeah. Come to my house and we do a tour of underground. Yeah, it's creepy. Sorry, it's probably illegal.
I'm just joking.
All the curtains will be closed now.
No, it's great. It's going to be a great show. And then right after that, we have I Hate Hamlet, which I'm also producing at the station. And that's February 13th through the 29th. And we'll be talking about that like later on. But it's coming down the
track
too.
So we have some great shows lined up to both promote these shows and then cover them after the fact, get some actors in. So 2020 is going to get off to a fast start. And like I said, we're going to wrap up 2019 in next week's show. So you want to catch that. We'll just, Linda and I will just we'll go through the whole year of all the shows and any feedback or not feedback, advance. what's the opposite of feedback? Feed forward. No, if you want to feed front us with like what you want to, like what meant something to you, what you remember, what you want us to talk about, let us know. Lots of ways to do that. Okay, so we are today's show is mostly about a really interesting story, interesting man, and I'm going to somehow have to like trim his interview short now. But I got to sit down with Peter McDowell, who is a local theater kind of like alum. He grew up here. He did shows as a boy at he did operas at Krannert with the U of I as a young man, and then as a student, he did shows at the station, he did shows at Uni High, and then he's gone on and he's had a career kind of peripherally in the arts, and now has undertaken a 10-year, almost like a mission of a project to uncover more about his family, in particular his brother, who is 19 years older than him, who passed away in Vietnam, not in the war, but he actually came home from the war, went back to Vietnam, and kind of had like a tragic slash mysterious death. And what Peter has done is he has, in the form of a documentary, gone and researched his family, researched his brother, his friends, his places, and it's really exciting. So it's, the name of the show is Jimmy in Saigon. I'm going to let Peter talk more about it, because otherwise you're just listening to me instead of him. But here's Peter McDowell talking about not just himself and this project, but also the event that he's coming into town for on Sunday, which is going to be Sunday at 4 p.m. at a wine bar in Urbana that is called, I think, Acoustic.
Analog?
Analog. I knew Analog. It was A.
Yeah.
And I knew it was three A. syllables.
Yes.
So, but thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, here we go.
This is Eric Schock to see you at the show. I am happy to be joined by Peter McDowell, an Urbana native who is now out in California working on a major film project. Peter will be returning to the area next week for a fundraiser for the documentary film that is currently in production or close to release. We can talk more about that in a minute, but welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you so much, Eric. Actually, I'm a native of Champaign, Illinois.
Okay, really?
Yeah.
All right, well, yeah. I guess when I saw Uni High, I assumed Urbana.
It's okay, but you know, I would say, both cities have a huge part in my life. I was born in Urbana at Carl Hospital and grew up in Champaign, you know, near Hessel Park and Westside Park, and then went to school all 5 years, high school at Uni High, and then went to University of Illinois for my undergrad and lived in Urbana that whole time. So I'm comfortable with both places and it feels like home to me.
Well, since it's see you at the show, obviously we embrace both of the communities, so we kind of cover our bases there. But this is, we talked briefly before we went on the air about us both being born in 1967, and now this is kind of getting spookier with the Carl, being born at Carl and then growing up by Hessel Park. So, because I did that too. So one of the reasons that we got hooked up together is because of our common theater friends. I know Kay Holly is involved in the fundraiser for your film that's taking place next week. What is your background in theater in the Champaign-Urbana area?
I got started really early, and I think the first thing I ever did was something with the Champaign Park District, a musical, way back in the 70s, and I think it was Once Upon a Mattress.
Okay.
I was a little kid, I was in that, and I got hooked, and then I sang at the with the children's choir at University of Illinois, also in the 70s, and I got roles. Well, I was in a lot of operas at U of I. My father was on the faculty of the School of Music, and so I was singing. I was a boy soprano. I sang in lots of operas at Krannert, and I ended up getting lead roles as a boy soprano in an opera called Amal and the Night Visitors, which I did in the late 70s. And then I think kind of transitioned into musical theater and did musicals at uni. And I got pretty excited to do musicals at the Station Theater in Urbana. And I was in about five or six plays and musicals, all of them in the 80s, and got to know the Station Theater really well and have a great fondness for that.
Great. Do you remember any of the shows that you did at the station?
Yes, I remember all of them. I was in West Side Story. I played Baby John. I was in Man of La Mancha. I was in Gypsy. I was in Evita. I was in Gory Stories. And I was in She Loves Me. And I think that those are all the shows that I did there. But very fond memories and still have friends from those days.
A documentary about your older brother, Jimmy. Why don't you set the stage for it rather than me?
Yeah, definitely. Well, this you know, the seeds of this go back obviously quite a ways as well. I'm the youngest of six children, and Jimmy was the oldest. And so he was 19 years older than me. He was born in 1948, grew up in Champaign, and I was born in 67. So, he was in the Army and he was in Vietnam, came back, finished his tour of duty in 1970 or so, and then went back to Vietnam in 1971 as a civilian, which was very unusual at the time. And less about a year later, he died suddenly and unexpectedly in Vietnam. So I was 5 years old when he died. He was 24. And there was a lot of shock and grief. It sort of turned my world around and my family's world around. And, you know, because I was a little kid, there was a lot that I wasn't privy to as a kid that I kind of learned as I grew up, because his death was not clear cut. There was some confusion about, you know, what was going on in his life. He had some mysteries and some secrets. And then as I got older, I got more and more interested in him. And in my 20s and 30s, I started talking with my mom and my parents about it and my siblings. I actually made a few short films when I was a grad student at UW-Madison in Wisconsin. And at that time, this sort of comes back to Champaign-Urbana Theater as well. I was dating Dan Savage. So I dated Dan Savage for 5 years. He was not famous then. I don't know, you know who Dan Savage is?
Yeah, I do. And I know that he was at the U of I and then went to Madison. So did you kind of go there together?
Yes, we met in college at U of I, and he was in the theater department. And when I went to grad school, he lived there with me, and we were talking a lot about film and my brother. And Dan said, "You should really make a documentary about your brother." And I said, "You know, I agree. I think that would be wonderful." And this was in the '90s, and then life kind of got in the way. And you know, he and I went our separate ways, remained very good friends, and. I've asked him to be an executive producer of the film, which he agreed to do happily. And so he is aligned with this project. He lives in Seattle with his husband. But at any rate, about 10 years ago, I was living in Brooklyn and I was in between jobs and I had a little bit of free space in my mind. And I thought, you know what? I think I'm going to try to make this film. And so I contacted a bunch of filmmaker friends, and I contacted my family. I contacted a lot of people, and every single person I talked to said, "Yes, this is a good idea. You should do it." So I spent the last bit of money I had to buy an HD camera, a used HD camera, and new sound equipment in Brooklyn. And I set out to interview everyone who ever knew my brother. And 10 years later, I have 65 hours of footage. I've traveled the country. I've been to France, to visit a friend of his there, and I've been to Vietnam twice, and I am now wrapping up the fifth of five fundraising events this fall to finish making the film, which essentially means for me hiring an editor to make the final edit and to do all the post-production, and I'm hoping to finish it in the spring.
Well, the pieces that you have on Jimmy, is it jimmyinsaigon.com? That's the website? Uh-huh. Okay. They seem very well produced already. Have you done that yourself, that 7-minute clip that you've got posted online?
I worked with professional editors, and I was very fortunate. I lived in Chicago for about 15 years, and I got very familiar with the folks at Kartemquin Films. And I don't know if you know much about Kartemquin, but they are Chicago's finest documentary house, and you know, they put together films such as Hoop Dreams and Life Itself, which was the film about Roger Ebert. Mm-hmm. So I worked with a number of editors associated with Kartemquin, but at that point I didn't have the money to hire a permanent editor, and I also I wasn't at that place. I didn't have like my story, my footage. I didn't have everything ready to go, but I did work with several excellent editors in Chicago to put together the stuff that that's on my site. And then also one of the big draws to coming to the event which, by the way, is happening on Sunday, December 22nd at 4 p.m. at Analog Wine Library in Urbana. One of the draws for people to come to that is that they can see an exclusive 14-minute demo of the film that's not available publicly. It's not on the site. One of the reasons that's not available, you know, besides just making it an exclusive thing at my events, is that I wouldn't say it gives away spoilers, but it's a little bit more in-depth than I would normally publish publicly in terms of some of the mysteries of the film. So that's a good reason for people to come.
Yeah, well, I know that just the trailers and then that 7-minute bit were, you know, they definitely whetted my appetite to learn more about the story. And so without asking you to reveal anything, is the kind of the conclusion, did it bring you some answers and some satisfaction and closure?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I tell people that the goal of this film is not first and foremost to be therapeutic. It's about creating, for me, a great work of art that will touch people, that will be beautiful and interesting. But if it happens on the side to have some therapeutic effects for me or my family or other people, I would be thrilled. And I think already that's happening. I think, you know, I come from a lovely, amazing, wonderful family, but we are a typical Midwestern family and we keep a lot of feelings down, deep down inside. And I think when my brother died in the early 70s, my family didn't have the best mechanisms for processing grief as a family. And also, it was hard for them to process ambiguity about his life and about his death. And so I've kind of taken on the idea of taking secrets and making them public. And, you know, this is controversial within a family, but I think that you know, my family has rallied around me in terms of the healing aspects of not hiding things and of bringing things to the surface. So that's partially what I'm doing is helping my family and other people to process through the idea of losing a loved one, losing someone young, and talking about it openly.
I think during some of your interviews, maybe mid-project, you mentioned that there wasn't necessarily universal enthusiasm among your siblings for this undertaking to happen. Was that the case and has that changed?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that there were some, there was some questioning when I first started where, I mean, albeit I initially proposed this to my family as an oral history project, which it is, but I don't think I necessarily proposed it as a publicly released documentary, which as I got further and further in on it, I became very clear that that's what I wanted to do with it. I think that they pretty quickly got over the aspect of it being public. I think one notion was that I think some of my family members felt like it was too sad to talk about my brother. And I have to respect the fact that my older brothers and sisters were all much closer in age to him. And he was almost kind of like a second father to our family. And he was really their hero. And they were all, you know, like I said, well, 10, 12, 14, 16, 19 years older than me. So they were in a little clump. So, you know, I didn't really know him that well. I have a little bit of distance that allows me to go through this process without so much emotion. But I'd say that was only at the very initial stages. And now I'd say everybody is really supportive of the project.
So it looks as though this is a film that touches on just a vast number of things, from the history of the war to the family dynamics, drug use, sexuality, so the scope seems incredibly broad.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And I think that, you know, he was a young man. He was a 24-year-old in the early 70s, and he was all about experimenting with what life had to offer him. And I think he was unlucky in some ways, but I'm very interested in that notion and in the notion of what do people, what kind of like rites of passage do people need to go through? And, you know, I think that he was rebelling against my parents at the time that he died. And I know that has been a source of sorrow for my mom, where she says like, he was, you know, really kind of anti his parents at the time he died. And I have to keep reminding her, I said, look, he was 24, you know, like he probably would have come out of that phase pretty quickly. And I do understand that sadness, but I think that I would also like to rewrite his story, because I think when I was growing up, the story was, oh, it's a tragedy, it's a tragedy, it's a tragedy. And what I'd like to say is like, his life was actually very interesting, and it was he had a very full, fulfilling life, a very interesting life. And I think for the most part, a very happy life, you know, with ups and downs. And so I'm interested in examining not only his death, but also his life, much of which was just sort of opaque to me before I started this project. I take as inspiration several documentary films, but one in particular that I really recommend is called The Witness. And it's a film about a famous murder in New York of a woman named Kitty Genovese.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, and the film was made by her brother, was really instigated by her brother, who was also younger than her when she died. And her death has been reduced to basically a tabloid headline. And he wanted to sort of reopen her case and say, like, what are the subtleties? What are the, what's the real truth about her life and her death? And also, what was her life? And, you know, as opposed to just her death. And I found that to be incredibly moving. And I think that's part of my journey with this film, is like, okay, let's look at his death, but let's also look at his life. And let's bring some things to life. I've had moments where I thought, my gosh, you know, I'm uncovering secrets. Is that unethical? Is it something that he wouldn't, you know, if he knew I was doing this, how would he feel? But I brought this up with a bunch of his friends, and they say, like, you know, no, don't worry about it. Like, let the truth out, let it all come out. It's the healthy thing to do. So,
well, you seem to have done both incredible work and been incredibly fortunate that he had friends that you could find that were this willing to talk about him and have such interesting recollections of his personality and his life. There are a couple snippets that are available on your site, and these are people who obviously still very much care about him.
Yeah, it was very moving to me. A lot of the people that I interviewed had not been in touch with my family for 40 years. So it was really like uncovering, you know, a hidden treasure, uncovering a box or a box in the attic that nobody had looked at for many years.
Did you literally use like boxes and attics of letters and photos and?
Sure. My mom saved almost every letter that he ever wrote to her, which is an archive that I have preserved, and I may even look into publishing at some point, because it's a real, the letters are from 1965 to 72. So it's like a real time capsule of a young man's development at that time. I also have letters that he wrote to other people, tons of photos. I have some Super 8 films. I don't really have much footage of him, any footage of him as an adult. I recently saw some home movies from my cousins and I ended up seeing the oldest pictures of him, oldest videos of him I had ever seen recently. So that was a nice discovery. But yeah, I mean, it's a special challenge to create a film surrounding someone who isn't around anymore and whose presence is ephemeral. You know, he's, you know, sort of the lead character in the film, but he's not in it because I don't really have footage of him as an adult. So it's an interesting challenge.
So 65 hours of footage, that's going to be quite an editing trick, because I bet like there's some kernel of interesting information probably in each one of those hours. Is your plan to make it a film rather than kind of like an episodic sort of maybe longer show?
Yeah, that's another great conversation. I have talked with people about this who've given me all sorts of advice. Everyone's got an opinion. And one person I talked to said, oh, you know, this is not a feature film. This is a short. This is 20 minutes at the most. And I was like, yeah, I don't know.
I was going the other way.